Side 16, The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Continuing on page 458.
These are the Tommyknockers,
he thought.
Bobby and the others aren't going to look exactly like them when they're done becoming. Maybe because of the environment, or maybe because the original physiological makeup of the, what would you call it, target group, results in a slightly different look each time this happens. But there's a kissin' cousin resemblance, all right. Maybe these aren't the originals, but they're close enough. Ugly fuckers.
He felt awe, horror, and a revulsion that ran blood deep.
Late last night and the night before,
a wavering voice sang in his mind.
Tommyknockers, Tommyknockers knocking at the door.
At first he thought there were five, but there were only four. One was in two pieces. None of them looked as if he, she, it, had died easily or with any serenity. Their faces were ugly and long-snouted. Their eyes were filmed over to the whiteness of cataracts. Their lips were drawn back in uniform snarls. Their skins were scaly but transparent. He could see frozen muscles laid in criss-cross patterns around jaws, temples, and necks. They had no teeth. 8. Bobby joined him. Guard saw awe on her face, but no revulsion.
These are her gods now, and one is rarely, if ever, revolted by one's own gods,
Gardner thought.
These are her gods now, and why not? They made her what she is today.
He pointed to each one of them in turn, deliberately, like an instructor. They were naked and their wounds were clear. Interstellar car crash, yes. But he didn't believe there had been any mechanical failure. Those weird, scaly bodies were slashed, scored with ragged cuts. One six-fingered hand was still wrapped around the haft of something that looked like a knife with a circular blade.
Look at them, Bobby,
he thought, even though he knew Bobby couldn't read him in here, even if he opened up all the way. He pointed here to a grinning mouth buried in another creature's throat, there to a wide wound gaping in a thick, inhuman chest, there to a knife still clutched in one hand.
Look at them, Bobby. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to see they were fighting. Having a good old knockdown drag out here in the old control room. None of this come let us reason together shit for your gods. They were whipping some heavy numbers on each other. Maybe it started as an argument about whether or not to land here, or maybe it was about whether or not they should have hooked a left at Alpha Centauri. Anyway, the results are the same. Remember how we always assumed a technologically advanced race of beings would be if one ever made contact with it? We thought they'd be smart, like Mr. Wizard, and wise, like Robert Young on Father Knows Best. Well, here's the truth, Bobby. The ship crashed because they were having a fight, and where are the blasters? The phasers, the transporter room. I see one knife. The rest they must have done with mirrors or their bare hands or those big claws.
Bobby looked away, frowning strenuously. A pupil who didn't want to learn the lesson. A pupil who was, in fact, determined not to learn it. She started to move off. Gardner caught her by the arm and pulled her back, pointed at the feet.
If Bruce Lee had had a foot like that, he would have killed 1,000 people a week, Bobby.
The Tommyknocker's legs were grotesquely long. They made Gardner think of those guys who don stilts and Uncle Sam suits and march in 4th of July parades. The muscles below the semi-transparent skins were long, ropey, gray. The feet were narrow and not precisely toed. Instead, each foot sloped into that one thick, chitinous claw, like a bird's talon, something like a giant vulture's. Gardner thought of the dips and the ladder rungs. He shuddered.
Look, Bobby. See how dark the claws are. That's blood, or whatever they had inside them. It's on the claws because they did most of the damage. This place sure as shit didn't look like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise before it crashed. Just before it hit, it probably looked more like a free-for-all cockfight out behind some redneck's barn. This is progress, Bobby. Next to these guys, Ted the Power Man looks like Gandhi.
Frowning, Bobby pulled away. Leave me alone, her eyes said.
Bobby, can't you see?
Bobby turned away. She wasn't into seeing. Gardner stood by the desiccated bodies, watching her climb the deck like a woman climbing a steep, smooth hill. She didn't slip at all. She turned toward a far wall where there was another round opening and boosted herself in. For a moment, Gardner could see her legs and the dirty soles of her tennis shoes. And then she was gone. Guard walked up the slope and stood for a moment near the center of the room, looking at the single thick cord coming out of the floor, at the earphones that split off from it. The similarity to the setup in Bobby's shed was perfectly clear. Otherwise, he looked around. Hexagonal room, barren, no chairs, no pictures of Niagara Falls, or Cygnus B Falls for that matter. No astrogation charts, no Mad Labs equipment. All the big-time science fiction producers and special effects men would have been disgusted by this emptiness, Gardner thought. Nothing but some earphones lying tangled on the floor, and the bodies, perfectly preserved, but probably as light as autumn leaves by now. Earphones, and remains like husks piled in that far corner, where gravity had tossed them. Nothing very interesting about it. Nothing very smart. That fit. Because the Havenites were doing lots of stuff, but none of it was very smart when you got right down to where the short hairs grew. It wasn't disappointment, he felt, so much as stupid correctness. Not rightness. God knew there was nothing right about this. But correctness, as if part of him had always known it would be this way when and if they got in. No Disneyland razzmatazz, only a dreary species of blankness. He found himself remembering W.H. Auden's poem about running away. Sooner or later, you always ended up in one room under a naked light bulb, playing solitaire at 3 in the morning. Tomorrowland, it seemed, ended up being an empty place, where people smart enough to capture the stars got mad and tore each other to shreds with the claws on their feet.
So much for Robert Heinlein,
Gard thought, and followed Bobby. 9. He trekked uphill, realizing he had entirely lost track of what his position was in relation to the world outside. It was easier not to think about it. He used the ladder to help himself along as he went. He came to a rectangular porthole and looked through it into something that might have been an engine room. Big metal blocks, square on one end, rounded on the other, marched off in a double row. Pipes, thick and dull silver in color, protruded from the square ends of these blocks and moved off at strange, crooked angles.
Like straight pipes coming out of a kid's jalopy,
Guard thought. He became aware of liquid warmth on the skin above his mouth. It divided in two and ran down his chin. His nose was bleeding again, slowly, but as if it meant to keep it up for a while.
Is the light brighter in here now?
He stopped and looked around. Yes. And could he hear a faint humming, or was that imagination? He cocked his head. No, not imagination, machinery. Something had started up.
It didn't just start, and you know it. We started it up. We're kicking it over.
He bit down hard on the mouthpiece. He wanted out of here, wanted to get Bobby out. The ship was alive. In a weird way, he supposed it was the ultimate Tommyknocker. It was a howl. It was also the most horrible thing of all. Sentient creature. What? Woke it up, of course. Guard wanted it asleep. All of a sudden, he felt too much like Jack nosing around the castle while the giant slept. They had to get out. He began to crawl faster. Then a new thought struck him, stopping him dead.
What if it won't let you out?
He pushed the idea away and kept going. 10. The corridor branched into a Y, left arm continuing to angle up, the right turning steeply downward. He listened and heard Bobby crawling to the left. He moved that way and came to another hatch. She was standing below it. She glanced briefly up at Gardner with eyes that were wide and frightened. Then she looked back again. He got one leg over the lip of the hatch and paused. No way was he going in there. The room was lozenge-shaped. It was full of hammocks suspended in metal frames. There were hundreds of them. All were canted drunkenly upward into the left. The room looked like a snapshot of a sailing ship's bunkroom, taken just as the ship rolled in the trough of a swell. All the hammocks were full, their occupants strapped in. Transparent skins, dog-like snouts, milky, dead eyes. A cable ran from each scaled, triangular head.
Not just trapped,
Gardner thought.
Chained. They were the ship's drive, weren't they, Bobby? If this is the future, it's time to eat the gun. These are dead galley slaves.
They were snarling, but Gardner saw that some of the snarls were half obliterated, because some of their heads seemed to have exploded, as if when the ship crashed, there had been a gigantic backflow of energy that had literally blown their brains out. All dead. Strapped forever in their hammocks. Heads lolling, snouts frozen in eternal snarls. All dead in this tilted room. Close by, another engine started up, chopping rustily at first, then smoothing out. A moment later, fans whirred into life. He supposed the newly started engine was driving them. Air blew against his face. Whether or not it was fresh was something he didn't intend to personally check on.
Maybe opening the outer hatch started this stuff up, but I don't believe it. It was us. What starts up next, Bobby?
Suppose they started up next, the Tommyknockers themselves. Suppose their grayish, transparent, six-fingered hands started to clench and unclench, as Bobby's hands had been doing as she stared at the corpses in the barren control room. What if those taloned feet began to twitch, or suppose those heads began to turn and those milky eyes looked at them?
I want out. The ghosts here are very lively, and I want out.
He touched Bobby's shoulder. She jumped. Gardner glanced at his wrist, but there was no watch there. Only a fading white shape on his otherwise tanned wrist. It had been a Timex, a tough old baby that had gone on a lot of toots with him and come out alive, but 2 days of working on the excavation had killed it.
There's one John Cameron Swayze never tried in those old TV ads,
he thought. Bobby took the point. She pointed at the air bottle clipped to her belt and raised her eyebrows at Gardner.
How long has it been?
Gardner didn't know and didn't care. He wanted out before the whole damned ship woke up and did God knew what. He pointed back down the passageway.
Long enough. Let's bug out.
A thick, oily, chuckling noise began in the wall next to Gardner. He shrank from it. Drops of blood from his slowly bleeding nose splattered the wall. His heart was beating madly.
Stop it. It's just some sort of pump.
The oily noise began to smooth out, and then something went wrong. There was a screech of grinding metal and a quick thudding series of explosions. Gardner felt the wall vibrate, and for a moment the light seemed to flicker and dim.
Could we find our way out of here in the dark if the lights went out? You make the joke, I think, senor.
The pump tried to start again. There was a long metallic scream that set Gardner's teeth biting at the rubber plugs in his mouthpiece. It died away at last. There was a long, loud rattle like a straw in an empty glass. Then nothing.
Not everything lasted all that time with no damage,
Gardner thought, and found this idea actually relieving. Bobby was pointing.
Go, guard.
Before he did, he saw Bobby pause and look back once at the ranks of hammock dead. That frightened look was back on her face. Then guard was crawling back the way he came, trying to keep an even steady pace as the claustrophobia wrapped itself around him. 11. In the control room, one of the walls had turned into a gigantic picture window, 50 feet long and 20 feet high. Gardner stood gape-jawed, looking at the blue main sky and the fringe of pines and spruces and maples around the trench. In the lower right-hand corner, he could see the roof tree of their equipment lean-to. He stared at this for several seconds, long enough to see big white summer clouds drifting across the blue sky, before realizing it couldn't be a window. They were somewhere toward the middle of the ship and deep in the ground as well. A window in that wall should show only more ship. Even if they had been near the hull, which they weren't, it would have given on a vista of mesh-covered rock wall with maybe a squib of blue sky at the very top.
It's a TV picture of some kind. Something like a TV picture, anyway.
But there were no lines. The illusion was perfect. Forgetting in this powerful new fascination his claustrophobic need to get out, Gardner walked slowly toward the wall. The angle gave him a perverse sensation of flying. The effect was like slipping behind the controls of an airline trainer and pulling the mock controls up into a steep climb. The sky was so bright he had to squint. He kept looking for the wall, the way you might expect to see a movie screen through the picture as you got closer to it, but the wall just didn't seem to be there. The pines were a true clear green. Only the fact that he couldn't feel any breeze or smell the woods worked against the persuasive illusion. He walked closer, still looking for the wall.
It's a camera. Got to be mounted on the outer rim of the ship. Maybe even the part Bobby stumbled over. The angle confirms that, but Jesus, it's so fucking real. If the people at Kodak or Polaroid saw this, they'd go out of their go.
His arm was grabbed. Grabbed hard, and terror leapt up in him. He turned, expecting to see one of them, a grinning thing with a dog's head, holding a cable with a plug tip in one end.
Just bend down, Mr. Gardner. This won't hurt a bit.
It was Bobby. She pointed to the wall, held out her hands and arms, and jittered them rapidly in some kind of charade, then pointed at the window wall again. After a moment, Gardner got it. In a grisly way, it was almost funny. Bobby had been miming electrocution, telling him that touching the window wall would probably be a lot like touching the third rail of a subway. Gardner nodded, then pointed toward the wider companionway through which they had entered. Bobby nodded back and led the way. As Gardner boosted himself up, he thought he heard a leaf-dry rattle and turned back, feeling a child's dreamy terror tug at his mind. He felt that it must be them, those corpses in the corner, them rising slowly to their taloned feet like zombies. But they still lay in their tangled drift of strange arms and legs. The wide, clear view of the sky and the trees on the wall, or through the wall, was dimming, losing reality and definition. Gardner turned away and crawled after Bobby as fast as he could. Chapter 7. The Scoop. Continued. 1.
You're crazy, you know,
John Leandro told himself as he pulled into exactly the same parking slot Everett Hillman had used now 3 weeks ago. Leandro did not, of course, know this. That was probably just as well.
You're crazy,
he told himself again.
You bled like a stuck pig. There's two teeth less in your head, and you're planning to go back there. You're crazy.
Right, he thought, getting out of the old car.
I'm 24, unmarried, getting bulgy around the middle, and if I'm crazy, it's because I found this. I did. Me. I tripped over it. It's big, and it's mine. My story. No. Use the other word. It's old-fashioned, but who gives a fuck? It's the right word. My scoop. I'm not going to let it kill me, but I am going to write it until it bucks me off.
Leandro stood in the parking lot at 1:15 on what was rapidly becoming the longest day of his life. It would also be the last. Despite all his mental avowals to the contrary, and thought,
good for you. Gonna ride it till it bucks you off. Probably Robert Capa, Ernie Pyle, thought the same thing from time to time.
Sensible. Sarcastic, but sensible. That deeper part of his mind seemed to be beyond such sense, however.
My story,
it returned stubbornly.
My scoop.
John Leandro, now clad in a T-shirt reading, Where the Hell is Troy, Maine? David Bright would probably have laughed himself into a hemorrhage over that one, crossed the small parking lot of Maine Med Supplies, specializing in respiration supplies and respiration therapy since 1946, and went inside. 2. $30 is a stiff deposit for an air mask, don't you think? Leandro asked the clerk, thumbing through his cash. He guessed he had the 30, but it was going to leave him with about 1.5 bucks. Wouldn't think they'd be a big black market item. We never used to require one at all, the clerk said, and we still don't if we know the individual or the organization, you know. But I lost one 2-3 weeks ago. Old man came in and told me he wanted some air. I figured he meant for diving, you know. He was old, but he looked tough enough for it. So I started telling him about down east scuba dive in Bangor. But he said no, he was interested in ground portability. So I rented it to him. I never got it back. Brand new Bell flat pack, $200 piece of equipment. Leandro looked at the clerk, almost sick with excitement. He felt like a man following arrows deeper and deeper into a frightening but fabulous and totally unexplored cavern.
You rented this mask, personally?
Well, it was a flat pack, actually, but yes. My dad and I run the place. He was delivering oxy bottles down to Augusta. I caught hell from him. I don't know if he'll like me renting another bell, even, but with a deposit, I guess it's okay.
Can you describe the man?
Mister, do you feel okay? You look a little white around the...
I'm fine. Can you describe the man who rented the flat pack?
Old. Had a tan. He was mostly bald. He was skinny. Stringy, I guess you'd say. Like I say, he looked tough.
The clerk thought.
He was driving a Valiant.
Could you check the day he rented the flat pack?
You a cop?
Reporter. Bangor Daily News.
Leandro showed the clerk his press card. Now the clerk also began to look excited.
He do something else? Besides rip off our flat pack, I mean.
Could you look up the name and date for me?
Sure.
The clerk flipped back through his rental book. He found the entry and turned the book so Leandro could read it. The date was July 26th. The name was scrawled, but still legible. Everett Hillman.
You never reported the loss of the equipment to the police, Leandro said. It was not a question. If a complaint of theft had been lodged against the old geezer to compliment his landlady's understandable unhappiness at being stiffed for 2 weeks' rent, the cops might have taken more interest in how or why Hillman had disappeared, or where he had disappeared to.
No, Dad said not to bother. Our insurance doesn't cover the theft of rented equipment, see, and, well, that's why.
The clerk shrugged and smiled, but the shrug was slightly embarrassed, the smile slightly uneasy, and taken together they told Leandro a lot. He might be a terminal twerp, as David Bright feared, but he was not a stupid one. If they had reported the theft or disappearance of the flat pack, the insurance company wouldn't cover the loss. But this fellow's father knew some other way they could stick it to the insurance company, but for now all that was very much a secondary consideration.
Well, thank you for all your help,
Leandro said, turning the book back around. Now, if we could finish up here.
Sure, of course.
The clerk was obviously happy to leave the subject of insurance behind.
And you won't put any of this in the paper until you check with my father, will you?
Absolutely not,
Leandro said, with a warm sincerity that P.T. Barnum himself would have admired. Now, if I could just sign the agreement.
Right. I'll have to see some ID first, though. I didn't ask the old guy, and I also heard from Dad about that, I can tell you.
I just showed you my press card.
I know, but maybe I ought to see some real identification.
Sighing, Leandro pushed his driver's license across the counter. 3.
Slow down, Johnny,
David Bright said. But Leandro was standing at an outdoor phone kiosk near the edge of a drive-in restaurant parking lot. He heard the beginnings of excitement in Bright's voice.
He believes me. Son of a bitch, I think he finally believes me.
As he had driven away from Maine Med Supplies and back toward Haven, Leandro's excitement and tension had grown until he thought he might explode if he didn't talk to someone else. And he had to. He recognized that as a responsibility that superseded his desire to get his scoop alone. He had to because he was going back, and something could easily happen to him. And if it did, he wanted to be sure somebody knew what he was on to. And Bright, as insufferable as he could be, was at least utterly honest. He wouldn't double-cross him.
Slow down. Yeah, I got to.
He switched the phone to his other ear. The afternoon sun was hot on his neck, but it didn't feel bad at all. He started with a ride to Haven, the incredible jam-up of stations on the radio, the violent nausea, the bloody nose, the lost teeth. He told him about his conversation with the old man in the general store, how empty the place had been, how the whole area could have been wearing a big sign that said, "Gone fishing." He didn't mention his mathematical insights because he could barely remember having them. Something had happened, but it was now all vague and diffuse in his mind. Instead, he told Bright that he had gotten the idea that the air in Haven had been poisoned somehow. That there had been a chemical spill or something, or maybe the escape of some natural but deadly gas from inside the earth.
A gas that improves radio transmissions, Johnny?
Yes, he knew it was unlikely. He knew all the pieces didn't fit yet, but he had been there, and he was sure it was the air that had made him sick. so he had decided to get some portable oxygen and go back. He related his coincidental discovery that Everett Hillman, whom Bright himself had dismissed as a nutty old man, had been there before him, on exactly the same errand. "So what do you think?" Leandro said finally. There was a momentary lag, and then Bright said what Leandro believed to be the sweetest words he had ever heard in his life.
"I think you were right, all the time, Johnny. Something very weird is happening out there, and I advise you very strongly to stay away."
Leandro closed his eyes for a moment and leaned his head against the side of the telephone. He was smiling. It was a large and blissful smile.
"Right. Right all the time."
Ah, they were good words. Fine words. Words of balm and beatitude.
"Right all the time."
"John? Johnny, are you still there?"
Eyes still closed. Still smiling, Leandro said,
"I'm here."
"Just relishing it, David, old man. Because I think I have been waiting my entire life for someone to tell me I was right all the time. About something. About anything."
"Stay away. Call the state cops." "Would you?" "Fuck no."
Leandro laughed.
"Well, there you go. I'll be okay. I've got oxygen." "According to the guy at the medical supply place, Hillman did too. He's just as gone."
"I'm going," Leandro repeated.
"Whatever's going on in Haven, I'm going to be the first one to see it and get pictures of it." "I don't like it. What time is it?"
Leandro's own watch had stopped. Which was funny. He was almost sure he'd wound it when he got up that morning.
"Almost 2. "Okay. I'll call in by 4, again at 6, etc., until I'm home and dry. If you or somebody there doesn't hear from me every 2 hours, call the cops." "Johnny, you sound like a kid playing with matches, telling his father if he catches on fire, Dad has permission to put him out." "You're not my father," Leandro said sharply.
Bright sighed.
"Look, Johnny, if it makes any difference, I'm sorry I called you fucking Jimmy Olsen. You were right. Isn't that enough? Stay out of Haven."
2 hours.
"I want 2 hours, David. I deserve 2 hours, goddammit."
Leandro hung up the phone. He started back to his car, then turned and marched defiantly back to the walk-up window and ordered 2 cheeseburgers with everything on them. It was the first time in his life he had ever ordered food from one of those places his mother called roadside luncheonettes. Only when she said the word, she made such places sound like the blackest pits of horror, as in, "It came from the roadside luncheonette," or "Earth versus the microbe monsters." When they came, the cheeseburgers were hot and wrapped in grease-spotted sheets of waxed paper with the marvelous words, "Dairy Burger Ranch," printed all over them. He had gobbled the first even before he got back to his Dodge.
"Wonderful," he said,
the word muffled to something that sounded like
"wonderful." "Wonderful, wonderful."
"Microbes, do your worst,"
he thought with almost drunken defiance as he pulled out onto Route 9. He was, of course, unaware that things were changing rapidly in Haven now, and had been ever since noon. The situation in Haven was, in nuclear parlance, critical. Haven had, in fact, become a separate country, and its borders were now policed. Not knowing this, Leandro drove on, tearing into his second cheeseburger, and regretting only that he hadn't ordered a vanilla shake to go with them.